All right, folks, welcome back to the Mindful Hunter podcast. I'm your host, as always, Jay Nickel. And today we are going to do a breakdown of my New Mexico late archery mule deer hunt. We will go over gear, what worked, what didn't, hunt tactics, what worked, what didn't. And then we're going to do a Q&A at the end that I posted on Instagram, which actually has some more generic questions about how to go hunting in the States. But I figure this is as good a opportunity to answer those as any other. And I think where I'll start is at the very beginning, which would be last year. So this is a tag that I drew, and I think this is particularly appropriate to talk about because it's application season right now. And I will try to put together a podcast on kind of my application strategy for all the Western states and British Columbia and all the rest of it. I had a really big takeaway from this hunt in regards to applying for draws. Typically, how things work is the more difficult a tag to draw is, the better the unit is. Now, that's not always the case, but there's a pretty strong correlation. And I think this hunt in particular, I got a little bit confused. Now, if you go look at the draw odds for this unit, they're 8%. And that's kind of middle of the road for New Mexico. So New Mexico does not have a bonus or preference point system. Everyone goes into the draw. It's a pure lottery. So everyone has equal odds. There's three different groups. You can apply in three different groups. You can either be a resident, a non-resident, or you go into the non-resident guided pool. And if you go into the non-resident guided pool, you have significantly better odds than going in on your own. And one little tactic you might want to keep in mind is there's a lot of outfits that will offer you like an extremely reduced outfitting package just to apply with them. So instead of doing like a full 7-day outfitted hunt for $8,000, you could do like a 2-day scouting package for $2,500. And basically it's just their way to make money off of letting you use their outfitting license to apply for the tag. But you would, if you did that, you would go down there, you meet up with them, and probably hang out with somebody for 2 days, hunt a little bit. They would show you the whole unit, give you some hot spots, and then kind of leave you on your own. I think the regulations are the guide has to spend at least 2 days with you over the course of your entire hunt. So he doesn't have to be with you the entire time. So if you really want to go to New Mexico and you don't mind dropping a couple extra bucks, it's a good tactic. Now, last year, I applied for Audad and deer. And to be honest, I was more interested in the Audad than the deer. Like, I spent more time researching what unit I wanted to hunt Audad in. And it's a simpler thing to research because there's not that many units in New Mexico that have Audad hunting. And I looked at the deer units and I thought I'd asked my buddy down there if it was a good unit, and it had 8% draw odds, which would indicate that it's a fairly decent unit. And so when I drew it, I was extremely excited. Like, I thought I'd got, you know, a tag equivalent to the elk tag I got in 2019. However, I went back and looked, and the odds of drawing that tag were 2.6%. Now, the difference in difficulty between drawing a tag that is 8% draw odds and drawing a tag that is 2.6% draw odds is very significant, like an order of magnitude greater difficulty. I know it only sounds like a 6%, you know, difference, and it wouldn't be that much, but the way statistics work, it is a significantly harder to draw a tag. So I think I was overestimating or underestimating how premium that 8% really was. Listen, long story short, the unit is not good at all for deer. And I'll get into that whole story, but I just wanted, because we're talking about application season, this was an application tag. The tag is only $350. But do not think that just because a tag looks hard to draw it is a premium unit. The other thing was I fell victim to confirmation bias on this one. I'm having a hard time remembering exactly what happened, but I think a buddy in New Mexico mentioned to me it was a good deer unit that was kind of under the radar. So when I did my research, I realized now I didn't pay enough attention to the conflicting evidence that I was finding, because I went back and read after I'd been there for a week. I'm like, how did I end up here, man? Because I thought this was a premium unit. I went back and read, you know, all the subscription services that I apply to and their unit descriptions and all that kind of stuff. And they were pretty clear that it was an oversubscribed unit. There was a ton of rifle tags for several seasons throughout the year, and that it used to be a really good tag, but it wasn't a good tag anymore. And I thought to myself, I really have no one to blame here but me. I mean, the evidence was there. I just didn't take the time to listen to it or to digest it, because, you know, I only wanted to see the information that agreed with my, you know, pre-existing opinion, which is the very definition of confirmation bias. So, I actually just finished my New Mexico application this morning for next year. I applied for ODAD again, and I applied for deer. And this time I shot the moon, because it's logistically challenging to get all the way to New Mexico. It's not somewhere you really want to drive from BC. It's about a 36-hour drive, even including just a couple of power naps. And that's really equivalent to 4 days travel, 2 days on either end of your hunt. So it's a grind. Now, I flew down and rented a vehicle, and that's, you know, a great option, but logistically it's very challenging. So if you're going to go all the way to New Mexico, you want it to be worthwhile. When I went down in 2019, that to this day is the best elk hunt I've ever had in my life. I would drive down every year if I knew I was going to get a unit like that. So going into this year's draw, I said to myself, I really only want to pull a deer tag if it is an unbelievable deer tag. So I really shot the moon on my deer tag this year and did the same thing with the ODAD. So highly doubt I will draw. One of the drawbacks of New Mexico is that you have to pay in advance. And then if you don't draw, you get a refund. So you need to be comfortable with, you know, what was it, $360 for an ODAD, $350 for a deer, another, you know, $65 for your hunting license, and $15 for an application fee. It's about $800 US. That's about, you know, $1,100 Canadian. And you got to be okay with that sitting on your credit card for 4 months until they draw, and you either, you know, they keep the money and you get the tag, or they give the money back because you didn't draw. So that's where I'm at with New Mexico for this year. Now, just to open the story, so draw tag, $350. A lot of people wanted to know what this hunt cost. I'll do a full cost breakdown at the end of the podcast, but this was this is any man's tag. Like there's no landowner tags. There's no guide. There's no bonus points to build up. Every single person who applied had the same odds as I did to draw the tag. And I think it's a very affordable tag. So for those of you looking for a Western state hunting experience, I do think as long as you're comfortable with the cash sitting on your credit card, New Mexico offers some great opportunities. Okay, so I draw the tag and then I start planning for the hunt. The other thing is, once I really started digging into the unit, I was like, oh wow, there are roads everywhere. So immediately I knew this is going to be a truck hunt. I'm going to bring a tent and all that kind of stuff, but I'm basically going to be day hunting from the truck every day. There's so many roads in this unit, you couldn't even... Now, I should qualify. There are a couple more remote portions of this unit, but they're not deer habitat. They're not prime deer habitat. They're more sheep habitat. So any of the area that was going to be like high percentage deer terrain, you couldn't even go in the backcountry if you wanted to. Like by the time you'd walk for an hour, you would have just hit another road. So this is another one of those examples where it's like, don't make the hunt something it isn't. If it is a heavily roaded unit, then hunt it like a heavily roaded unit. But the takeaway for me on that front is, again, I should have done more e-scouting before I applied, because I am just not a big fan of heavily roaded units. I hunted this unit and the unit I was in Colorado this year, both of them, you know, fairly highly pressured with a lot of roads, and it's just not my first choice for hunting style. So I'm going to do what I can to really not put any of those hunts in the calendar next year. So start planning for a truck hunt, reach out to a couple buddies in New Mexico off of Instagram. Luckily enough, I, you know, get put in touch with the guy who lives in the unit. He gave me a little bit of intel, like real kind of generic vague stuff, but enough that I was like, okay, I've got a general game plan. So organize some flights, organize some a rental truck. And basically I flew into Albuquerque, picked up a rental truck and drove about 4 hours to get to my unit. Now, getting to the hunt itself, I landed to an absolute shit show. So full-blown blizzard in Albuquerque. Traffic was dead stopped. I picked up the rental truck and I literally went and sat on the side of the road for an hour and a half and did not move. At that point, I should have immediately got off at the next exit and just grabbed a hotel, because there are some sections of New Mexico that are so remote, you drive for like 3 hours at 10 or 11 o'clock at night and there's not a single open hotel. And so I ended up having to drive significantly further than I wanted to, which ended up being a good thing the next day, but it made that first night, you know, really challenging. So get there the first day. The guy who lived in the unit also had an ODAD tag, and he was going to be staying in his trailer, you know, kind of out in the, like, the lower portion of the unit in this like borderline deer ODAD country. So I was supposed to meet up with him in the afternoon at day one. So went and scouted by myself in the morning, didn't turn anything up, met him in the afternoon, kind of got camp squared away, went out that afternoon and turned up a buck. Now, not a great buck, like probably a 130 type buck. And right away he was like, you know, that's kind of what you're going to see here. Like, if I were you, I'd go make a play on this buck. And I was like, night one, I don't know. It was getting kind of late. And we both agreed that, you know, I should probably make a play on the buck, but let's let it sit until the morning. So we put that buck to bed, went back to camp. I had brought my tent and all my gear. So we were basically at this big turnout kind of flat area off the highway, and he had a fifth wheel trailer and I had my tent, and we just, you know, camped for the night, ate, slept, did all that. Woke up the next morning, went back to that location and turned up the buck pretty quickly. Now, the issue with this particular location, which would, you know, come to be part of the challenge of this particular unit, is that there's a lot of the unit that's not conducive to archery hunting. So this first night, this first area where I put the stock on the buck is basically like, I want you to think of like a rim, like a giant long, like literally tens of kilometers long sloping hill that's like sloping up and away from you up to a flat plateau on top. Maybe, I don't know, 1,000, 1,500 feet in elevation gain, something like that, with like a nice gentle slope to the hill until it gets to the kind of top half, and then it just cuts straight up to a cliff. The issue being, any animal that is up on that hill has this dominating view of the landscape below. So anything you do down there, they're watching you. Like, there's no cuts to cut up, there's no washes. There's a couple places on that hill where if he bedded in just the right spot, it would be a little more conducive to a play. Anyways, I threw the play. I got to within, you know, 250 yards. I feel like the deer were watching me the entire time, and it really just, as soon as I got close enough that it made them uncomfortable, they basically just got up and walked away. But they didn't really like blow out hard. So we decided to leave those deer and continue on. And so I'm trying to remember, you know, the exact you know, order of events, but that, like, it was a long hunt. It was 10 full days of hunting with one travel day on either side. So 12 days of hunt. So anyways, at that point, yeah, that was Saturday, and we did that in the morning, and then Hayden, remember, he had an Oddad tag, so we decided to go hunt Oddad for Saturday afternoon. So we went, we were able to find some Oddad. He went in to make a stalk and actually blew out a couple of deer on the way, which was unfortunate because he had a great shot opportunity on a 3x3. You know, again, not a very special deer, like a, you know, maybe 130-ish, 135-ish type deer. And had a shot opportunity, but ended up blowing that deer and a doe out, and they blew out the Oddad that he was chasing. The other thing that I should mention for people who aren't familiar with mule deer, in particularly southern extents of their range, this was peak rut. Well, it was supposed to be peak rut. I feel like the rut really didn't start kicking off until the tail end of the hunt. But the idea is the late archery tag in New Mexico for mule deer is the more coveted season to be archery hunting. Although, the more I do deer hunting, the more I'm actually coming to the conclusion that the rut is an ideal time to hunt mule deer with a rifle, but I'm not convinced that the rut is an ideal time to hunt mule deer with a bow. Because the issue is they are extremely mobile and extremely unpredictable. Like, you can see them because they're up and moving around, but getting them to do something that provides a good stalking opportunity is a completely different scenario. And so at that point, we decided to, he made his stalk, he blew his stalk, we decided to go back to camp. The next day was Sunday, and I was getting low on fuel at this point. And so we made a game plan where we would go hunt the morning together and then, go into town and try and hunt an area closer to town for the afternoon. Where I was, you know, really far from any type of gas station. And I should have, in hindsight, I should have brought a couple jerry cans in with me that first night, 'cause I could have stayed a lot longer. 'Cause once you're in there, you're not doing like really crazy driving, you know, maybe 50, 60 miles a day. But with a couple of jerry cans, I could have made it another 3 or 4 days probably. And so we went and scouted a bunch of more territory in the morning. And the real story of this hunt was that you could turn up some does, but because the rut wasn't really kicked off, it wasn't necessarily a sign that you should stick with those does and a buck was going to turn up. Like, there was a ton of does with no bucks. And so ran around that morning, turned up a couple does, didn't really see any bucks, went back to camp, had lunch, packed up. And then we went to like a pretty far, different corner of the unit. And we started seeing a little bit more action there. But again, it was that took us to the evening of Sunday. I went back to town, got some gas, dropped him off at his truck, and he's actually in his last year of high school. So he had to go back to school for the week. I loaded up on some more fuel and stuff and went back to camp. The other thing that I need to mention at this time is that it is incredibly windy. This, literally the entire 10 days, it blew between 40 and 60 miles per hour. That is not a word of exaggeration. This was the windiest hunt I've ever been on in my life. There were days where you couldn't even stand without leaning on something. Like, it was blowing you around that viciously. Glassing offhand was not an option the vast majority of the time. You would either have to sit down and get your tripod as low as possible to get out of the wind, or you would have to glass from the truck. And I will bring this up later in the optics section, but I think this would have been a prime use case for those new SIG Zulu 6s, because sitting in the truck, having that additional stabilization that would nullify the effect of the truck shaking, I think would have been a game changer. You could still glass pretty effectively from the truck, but it would have taken your effectiveness to a completely different level. So anyways, I go back into the kind of remoter area of the hunt, and I hunt by myself for the next couple days, basically. And it was moderate. Again, I'm turning up maybe 6 or 7 deer a day. The story of this unit is that there are decent deer numbers, but there are very few mature bucks. I saw 3 mature deer that I would consider shooter deer the entire hunt. And everything else I saw was like a very small buck or does, and probably saw, I don't know, maybe 150 deer, maybe 100 deer over the course of the 10 days, something like that. Like, there were days we turned up 30 deer, but it would literally be 27 does and 3 tiny bucks, like little 2x2s or a little spindly 2x3 that would be like 120 inch deer or something, like real small deer. Like, I'm not going all the way to New Mexico to shoot something like that. So basically, and maybe what I'll do from here, because there's no point doing a detailed breakdown of every day, because this was really a rinse and repeat hunt. Essentially what happened, we met up again in the afternoon on day 4 or 5 and went to the northern portion again and turned up better deer again. And at this point, it's like immediately clear, okay, this is the hot spot. This is where we want to be. If we have any chance of turning up a decent buck, this is where it's going to be. So at that point, I pull up camp and I move to town, and I did a hotel show for the rest of the hunt. And I would basically hunt by myself for the morning and then go pick up Hayden, and we would hunt together in the afternoon. And then Hayden came out and hunted hard with me again for Saturday. And then my last day, Sunday, he spent half a day with me, and then he broke off to go hunt Audad, and I went and finished my mule deer hunt by myself. But basically, the highlights at that point, because every day is the same, drive around, cover country, glass from the road, try and turn up a buck. Now, there was one day where I ended up making 3 plays on the same deer. The issue was, again, this terrain is so open that it's very challenging to make archery plays. And basically, what happened all 3 times, the first 2 times with this buck, I was basically making a stalk from maybe 1,300 yards away. And at some point during the hunt, either myself or Hayden or both of us would have to lose sight of the buck. And both times, by the time I got all the way over to where I was going, the deer were gone. And that's what I mean about the challenges of archery hunting mule deer in the rut. Because, you know, your classic mule deer archery hunting strategy is glass them, put them to bed, make a play. As long as the sun doesn't kick them out of their bed, or something else doesn't kick them out of their bed, you should have 1 to 2 hours to get over there and make a play with a reasonable expectation that that buck is going to be in the same location. Well, the problem with hunting them in the rut is, like, you just get none of that. They sit down, they hop up, they run left, they run right. You try and predict which way they're going to go so you can make an ambush play. And then halfway there, they turn around and go the other direction. Like, it's just very low predictability. So make those 2 plays on that same buck. Again, maybe he's like a 140 type buck, like not a great buck by any stretch of the imagination. But at this point of the hunt, we're day 5 or 6. I've seen what the unit has to offer. I'm like, this is about all we got. So I do think you need to let the realities of the unit impact your expectations for a hunt. And if it's a smaller deer unit, then it's a smaller deer unit. And you just got to try and get the biggest thing that you can find in that unit. So make those two plays, get all the way over there and no deer, kind of frustrating. And then right at like half an hour before, you know, sunset, we're coming back out through this same area and we turn the deer up a third time. And it's like a Hail Mary play. Like I'm literally grabbing my bow and sprinting across this open field. I'm maybe 700-800 yards from the deer. And at this point, it turned out to be my best stalk of the hunt. I got to within, I want to say sub 200 yards, maybe 180 yards, basically stalked all the way over, hopped a couple fences, was able to get on my hands and knees and crawl over and got over this ridge. And I was able to glass up the buck with his does at like 180. And then I dogged them for maybe 200-300 yards as they were moving through these canyons. And then they went up and over a ridge. And based on the direction that they were going when they went over the ridge, I kind of went down the ridge on the backside to hop over and hoping to intercept them as they were going cross face on the far side of the ridge. And Hayden, who was glassing them up at the time, told me later that basically as soon as they got on the other side of the ridge, they immediately switched directions 180 degrees and went the other way over and out of sight. So I came over the ridge right at sunset, kind of a last ditch opportunity. And again, just no deer. They just disappeared. And I was just like, ugh. Like at this point, it's like, it's starting to get to me. Right. So we basically continue on the same way. And then on the app, you know, glassing, covering country, don't have any more plays, don't find any more shooter bucks. And then on the evening of day 7, I have my best stalk of the hunt. And so at this point, we find a nice buck. Like for this unit, like he's probably like high 150s, like a nice mature 3x4. You know, they got those like dark gray desert horns, like a great buck. I would have been very excited to shoot this buck. And he's with 11 does. We see him from the road. He's up on this hillside and they disappear just over the back of the hillside and basically dip into this little cut. And so I kind of circle around, get out of the truck, circle around behind them and basically run on the backside of this ridge so that I can pop over and hopefully get a shot down into the cut from the far side. And the wind is in my favor. And again, it's howling wind, easily 40, 50 miles per hour at this point, like unbelievable, like just beating you down. And so I make my play. I crawl on my hands and knees. I peek up over the ridge and the deer are exactly where I want them to be, but they're a little further up the cut away from me than I thought they were going to be. I'm like, okay, so that's good. Take another updated point of my Onyx where they think they are. Dump back off the backside of the ridge, run around the far side ridge a little bit further, and then pop back up and over maybe 300-400 yards further up, thinking I'm going to drop in right on top of them. And as soon as I get to the crest of the ridge, I see a doe on the far face, kind of working her way up out of the cut. And I'm like, okay, this is perfect. This is exactly where I need these deer to be. And I see a decent sized yucca. That's the other thing. Where I am, there is nothing to use as cover. Like there's no trees, there's no large bushes, there's no pinyons, there's no big juniper, like nothing. But there is this odd, you know, decent sized yucca. So I see a decent sized yucca. I kind of belly crawl over to that. And then as soon as I do, I'm sitting behind the yucca, kind of glassing through the fronds of the yucca. And I turn up the buck and I range him at 105 yards. And I'm like, this is perfect. I just need him to like come my way a little bit. And at this point, like, I'm not going to lie, that like taking a shot starts to pass through your head. Now, 105 yards is a ridiculously far shot. And it's one of those things that passes through your head and you immediately say to yourself, I'm not going to take this shot. Now, taking a shot at 60, 70, 80, these are not completely unrealistic, possibilities. However, in this wind, they are. Now, the reason I bring this up is that I sat at 105 yards from this buck for a solid 20 minutes. At that point, I think I probably could have belly crawled to 80, but then the hill rolled away in such a way that I was going to be so open and so close to them, and he had 11 does with him, that there was no way I wasn't going to get busted. Like, it just would have been ridiculous. And because of the wind, getting to 80 did me no more good than being at 105. Like, there was no way I was going to take a shot at 80 in that wind. And so I just sat there at 105. Now, there are about four different routes those deer could have taken out of that cut. All of them except one would have done something that would have given me a shot opportunity, or at least allowed me to extend the play. And they took number four. And so I sat behind that yucca for almost 2 hours in 40, 50 mile per hour winds, just watching these deer. And they just slowly kind of worked their way away from me. And where they were on the hillside, anything that I did would have exposed me. And I wanted them to go back up and over the top of the face that they were currently on, because then they wouldn't have been able to see me and I could have gone down through the cut and popped back over on top of them again. Like, the wind was good from that direction, but they just wouldn't go over. They wouldn't go down into the cut. They wouldn't go over. They wouldn't come out the back. All they did is kept working this face, kind of mid face, right away from me, and very slowly. And so, yeah, sat there, got dark, couldn't make a play, finally decided to get up and try and force something with about 10 or 15 minutes of daylight left. And they immediately picked me up. They were maybe at like 220 at that point. And I was far enough away, and I was kind of disguised enough that they didn't blow out hard. They just kind of ambled off. And I tried to follow them thinking they might have stopped on the other side, and I got, and the deer were gone. And the reason I want to spend some time on this opportunity is that it was the best opportunity of the entire hunt. And I've gone over it in my head a dozen times. I honestly feel like I did everything right. And I don't see an opportunity where I could have done anything else differently. And it's just the way the hunt goes. If he had of broke right instead of broke left, he would have basically walked right up past me, and I would have, and that was the way he was headed. Again, I want to go back to the rut. Like, watching deer move for a decent amount of time in one direction, going and placing yourself in front of them in that direction with the wind being favorable, it's reasonable to assume that they're going to keep coming towards you. But these rutting deer are just completely unpredictable. Like, there's just no pattern to the way that they move around. And so how challenging the terrain is to get a stalk, coupled with the fact that they won't sit still or move in a predictable direction, it just makes it an incredibly challenging hunt. So yeah, I believe that was the evening of day 7. We then hunted hard all of day 8. Now, on the evening of day 8, I had another shot opportunity, but again, a small buck. And it was literally one of these roadside bucks where you're driving and glassing, you turn him up. I literally got out of the truck. I got my bow. He was 42 yards from where I was standing. I came back to full draw. I settled my pin on this buck. I'm looking at him. He's looking at me. I'm looking at his antlers. And I was just like, this isn't right. This is not the buck that I want to shoot. I'm at a point now where I expect more from myself. And so I let down. And he looked at me for another 3 or 4 seconds and then just kind of walked away off into the pinyons. Now, those two elements for me were the big wins of the hunt. You know, that's one of my better stocks I've ever made on an animal, getting into 105 and basically sitting there for 2 hours undetected. And then I'm always striving to be the kind of hunter that's targeting mature animals. But sometimes you have to ask yourself, is that really the case, or you just not have that many opportunities and you're lucky enough to find something decent size when you do shoot something? And to be able to come to full draw on an animal, have the opportunity to, you know, quick, clean kill and decide, no, that's not the animal for me. I'm better than this. I'm going to hold out. At that point, there's still two more full days of hunting to go and let that animal walk. That was a really big win for me. And then basically there's not much more of the hunt. We hunt all day, day eight. We did turn up one more nice buck, but never had a shot opportunity on him. And then the last day we hunted together the first half of the day, and then the second half of the day we split up. I got one last Hail Mary right at sunset on the evening of day 10. As I was driving out, I saw a buck with a single doe head up over this ridge, and I literally threw the truck in park and just sprinted to get up behind them. And by the time I got over the ridge, it was too dark, and I don't know where they went. And again, they just didn't, you know, they didn't go where I expected them to go. And so that was my hunt. It was, you know, a great learning experience. I glassed a ton. I think I, you know, definitely picked up some glassing skills along the way. I definitely picked up some stalking skills along the way. I've always been like with archery, like I feel lethal inside of 60 yards, and I've never really focused too much on being lethal outside of that, because I've never really been in situations where being lethal outside of that would have done me any good. I tend to hunt a lot of timber. However, after this hunt, I do think I want to spend some more time practicing at long distances, because I would like to be proficient out to 80 if one of those perfect situations pops up where the animal is unaware of me, the wind is completely died down, and I do have a shot at 80. Because the thing with archery is sometimes you're better off a little bit further out. If you try and push it and get too close, and the animal becomes aware of you, it, you know, a shot at 40 when they know you're there is worse than a shot at 60 when they don't. So I do, you know, I am going to work on increasing my distance of lethality a little bit. But I already talked about the lessons learned about the draw and the lessons learned about the heavily roaded elements of the hunt. So, yeah, overall, I really enjoyed myself. It was one of the more challenging hunts I've been on, and it was challenging in a way that I didn't really like, which I think was good for me. Like, I like going to the backcountry, busting my ass, having these grand adventures, and like, yeah, that's hard and the success rates are low, but there's like this nobility and this epicness to it. There's very little nobility or epicness to a hunt like the one I just did. And so sometimes I think it's good to be reminded that we don't always get to choose the kind of hard that we need to face. And seeing what you're made of when you're forced into a situation that you don't want to be in is sometimes a better indicator of how mentally tough you actually are. And I gave it everything I had for 10 straight days. So I feel good about that. Now let's transition and talk a little bit about the gear that I used on this hunt. All right, let's start with the pack. I took an Exo K4 7200. A lesson learned here is I packed it pretty full and I flew with it, and it kind of got the shit kicked out of it. It kind of bent the stove that I took with me and put a hole in the pack. And I think what I'm going to do is buy a gigantic wheeled duffel bag. And so when I go to do these kind of travel backpack hunts, then I can put my backpack inside the duffel bag empty and then pack my gear on top of that, so that things aren't as tightly compressed in the backpack and it's in a more travel-friendly pack. It was nothing earth-shattering and it'll be fine. It's a quick little repair, but it was just like, oh, this is not an, and I've done this before and I never had any problems, but I don't think it's the ideal way to travel when you're going on these hunts. Now for my tent, I use the Sea to Summit Telos TR2. Very happy with the performance of the tent. Incredibly high winds. Tent held up beautifully. No problems there. Big Agnes Q-Core SLX sleeping pad. Slept like a baby. Took my Enlightened Equipment Enigma down quilt. The other thing that I did is it ended up being significantly colder than predicted. So I ran to Walmart after I landed, and I'd already planned on getting a full-size pillow because it's like, well, why not? You know, you're going to be packing things up into the truck every day and you don't have to hike anything in the backcountry. There's no point using a shitty inflatable pillow when you can have a nice one every night. So while I was at Walmart, I picked up a big blanket, like a comforter that you'd put on your queen size bed. And I used that on top of my down quilt and slept like a baby. Now, the other thing that I picked up at Walmart was a cooler. And the idea being I could use it to transport the meat in when after I killed. And then if I could get the meat processed and frozen, I could fly home with the cooler kind of duct taped. And it was like a 40 liter cooler, like a, you know, typical Coleman. I think it was an Igloo or something like that. $25 at Walmart. Also, right after I landed, I went to Cabela's and I picked up an archery target so that I could make sure my bow was still sighted in, and some isobutane for my stove because you can't fly with that. And then a 25 liter water jug so that when I was, you know, camping, I wouldn't run out of water. Now, as far as clothes, I used the Stone Glacier Avro hoodie, which I'm a big fan of. I stuck with my Lulu Air Mesh long boxers as always. Sitka Ascent pants, which are my favorite hunting pants by a big margin. And everybody keeps telling me to review the Intercepts, so I'm probably going to have to look at those soon. For boots, the Schnee's Beartooth, loved them, performed phenomenally. Darn Tough Overcalf socks, an Arcade stretchy belt. I used the new gaiters from Ape Equipment. Fantastic. I did have one buckle issue, and he's going to ship me a replacement buckle. The Sitka Ambient hoodie. It was the perfect piece of gear for this hunt. And then I had this Stone Glacier Grooming puffy jacket. That was a miss. In fact, what I probably should have taken is the Stone Glacier Cirque Light jacket to wear over top of the ambient hoodie. In the desert, there's all kinds of thorns and mesquite and cacti, and that puffy got caught on everything. And it was so windy that it was kind of blowing right through the puffy. And so I think for the desert, when you're going to have a significant amount of wind, I think having some type of soft shell instead of a puffy would have been a better choice. I had a pair of Merino gloves from MEC that are just like thin glove liners. They're like $12 a pair. They're just knitted Merino. And those things, they're perfect, but they don't last very long. Like I only get one or two hunts out of a pair, and then they start popping holes in them and kind of coming apart all over the place. But I tried to wear my mechanics gloves, but those mechanics gloves don't cut the wind very well. So they weren't keeping my hands very warm. And for headwear, I did a combination of the Sitka Jetstream beanie and the Sitka ball cap. And that Jetstream beanie was really the winner of the hunt because it would Jetstream products from Sitka have Windstopper in them. And that really shone on a hunt like this that was so windy. For glass, I took my Zeiss Harpyon 95, which performed remarkably well. It really is a very great like spotting scope for viewing. There's a couple of things I don't like about it. But overall, you can't complain. Like the 95 is just a phenomenal viewing experience. I took the Revic 10x42 range-finding binos, and I have a review on those coming out. But if I was just to give you... Okay, for starters, bringing range-finding binos on an archery hunt, I do not recommend anyone do that. They're incredibly heavy. They're very bulky. Makes it very difficult for one-handed glassing. And I'm not a big fan of these Revix. I don't want to dig into it too much until I have a chance to put them head to head with some other optics, because reviewing things in isolation is always dangerous. But the glass is not very good. I'm going to be honest. It's not bright. Pulling focus is challenging. Like the Zeiss SFLs I used on the Colorado hunt before this blow the Revix out of the water. Like, I will take those SFLs every single day of the week. They're brighter, they're cleaner, they're crisper, better resolution, better edge-to-edge clarity, less chromatic aberration. The focus is miles better. For just pure optical performance, the Revix are going to get a pretty low score from me. I was not impressed at all. And I haven't looked through that Revix spotting scope, but I would urge people to proceed with caution. It just went on sale the other day at a local store here from like $3,500 to $1,700. And it actually wouldn't surprise me that kind of poor sales performance is why those are going on such steep sale, because the glass in that line is not good. Bino harness, use my Alaskan Guide Creations rangefinder, Leupold RX 1200 TBR. I brought two tripods. I brought the Asiac tripod for my camera, and then I brought the Slick 734. I will do a review on the Slick 734 next week. It is without a doubt the single worst tripod I've ever used in my life. Three or four different components seized up on it. It's hard to use. There's things that slip. Like, I can't even get into all the things that suck about that tripod. It is hands down the worst tripod I've ever used in my life. Slick 734. Don't touch it with a 10-foot pole. It's a piece of shit. My bow, I use the Prime RVX 34. I'm loving that bow. Review and raffle to come out on that, hopefully by the end of the month. I don't need to get into my camera gear. Some other kind of miscellaneous stuff that I brought. A Thermarest pad that I use for sitting on. I brought, you know, a couple knives, but I didn't really kill anything, so there's no point in kind of getting into that. Brought my SteriPen, never used it. Brought my Garmin InReach, never used it. I was using a phone scope for digiscoping. Couple other little things that don't really matter. For a stove system, I was using the Ollie Camps titanium. It's called an XPS or something. I can't remember. I'll have to look it up. I'm loving that stove system. It is the lightest, quickest combo that I've used yet. I think the Jet Boil might be marginally quicker, but it's significantly heavier. It's great. I like it a lot. You can buy it on Amazon. Peaks Backcountry headlamp worked phenomenally well. Food, I did the same thing I always do. Go watch one of my food videos. It's literally like green belly for lunch, granola and protein for breakfast, peak refuel for dinner, and then a combination of like protein bars and nuts and other stuff for snacks. I'm going to be revamping my entire system going into this coming year because I want to have some more kind of natural foods and less processed, prepackaged stuff. Okay, so let's dig into the Q&A. If there's anything I went over too fast or anything you want more clarification on, just let me know. And some of these questions don't have anything to do with the hunt, but whatever, let's just pound through them real quick. My buddy from Vancouver Island, Darren, says cougar video on the island next winter. 100%, man. He just got some cougar dogs, so if you wanna have me over and go chase a cougar, I'll be there. Name the date and time. Is Vancouver still a good home base, or have you thought about relocating for the business? There's two elements going into this. If it was up to me, I would have relocated years ago. But my wife is a city girl, And having her in the city makes my life easier because I can travel more because she has some more support here and she's happier here. So her being happier and having more support means she's more open to me leaving more often. So even though it's a pain in my ass to live here, it works out better for me in the long run because I can take more trips. The other interesting thing is that she's been trying to get us to move to Toronto for a year. For a long time. For what she does, she could do a lot more business there. And so we're kind of toying around with the idea of like a sabbatical in Toronto for maybe 6 to 12 months, rent out our house here and just kind of do a temporary relocation in order to facilitate business growth for her. And I thought from a hunting perspective, you know, that might not even be a bad thing. I could spend a year kind of focused on, East Coast hunting instead of West Coast hunting. And I could get, you know, do more whitetail stuff. I could do some bird stuff. There's some interesting hunts in Ontario. So I don't know. We'll see what happens there. What about hunting in Mexico? Definitely considering it. I almost booked a coos hunt with Jay Scott this year on one of those DIY ranches. I was trying to do this kind of group thing and it kind of fell through. And I am interested about mule deer in Sonora. So someday, I would not be surprised if I end up in Mexico. Revic binos, you pick these over your pures if you had to just use one to do it all, not even close. You would have to peel the pures out of my cold dead hands. The pures and the Revics are not even in the same league as far as optical performance. And I think it's handy. I'll get into this more in the range finding portion, like the actual range finding binocular review that I'm going to do. Unless you are a guide who works with rifle hunters regularly, or you are like a hardcore rifle hunter, that, because here's the thing, I think even for the hardcore rifle hunter, if you're using your range finding binoculars as your primary glassing tool, I wouldn't recommend the Revics because the optical performance is just not good. But if you're somebody who like glassing is not a big part of what you do, or you're using a spotting scope or a different pair of binos, like 15s for the majority of your glassing, and the Revics are just part of your system, I think they could serve a role. What would you have done differently knowing what you know now about the hunt? Easy, I would not have applied for this unit. That was a mistake. I didn't do my research correctly, and it would have solved all the problems had I just not gone. What was the cost of the trip? Okay, let's break this down. Tag was $350. Flight and truck for the week was $1,500. So let's round that up and say that's $1,900. Probably spent $400 on fuel. So that's $2,300. Probably spent another $400 on food. So that's $2,700. Probably spent $400 on hotels. So that's $3,100. And then some supplies, some extra stuff. Let's even just round it up and say it was another $400. So probably $3,500 all in. Travel, food, expenses, accommodation, tag, all of it. $3,500, 12 days going from BC to New Mexico. And I think, so probably could have saved about $500 if I took my own vehicle. I wouldn't have had the flight and the vehicle rental expense, but I would have had more gas expense. So yeah, and that's about the best you're going to do. Like anytime you start traveling, you know, 20 hours from your house or taking flights or, you know, the food and the gas and the accommodations bumped it up a little bit. Would have saved money if I could have spent more time in a tent. But it's pretty nice to, you know, eat out every night and sleep in a hotel, especially when you're getting your ass kicked. So that's the cost of the trip. What was the plan to get the meat back if successful? I would get the meat back to town, have it processed and frozen, put it into cooler, duct tape it, put it on as an extra checked bag, and then you can bring meat back and forth across the border, no problem. I was listening to a hunt, listening to a podcast the other day, and somebody said when they were trying to bring meat from Canada down into the States, they were asked for a CITES permit. And that really surprised me, because there's maybe that's an American thing, but there is no regulation or law whatsoever that prohibits you from bringing game meat from the United States back into Canada. You literally, they get a little bit, there's a little bit of gray area around like skulls and brain matter and spinal cord tissue, largely because of CWD and other things. So I always leave my mounts down there and get them euroed and then go pick them up once they're processed. And I usually try and debone the meat to bring it home, but I've not deboned it a couple times and it wasn't an issue at all. Somebody says, if I ever find myself on Vancouver Island, let's go fishing. I do like fishing. And so, yeah, let's make that happen. Will I ever do a bow sight review? Yes, I absolutely will. Any desire to ever live in the States? I would love to live in the States. And much like we've talked about the Toronto opportunity, me and my wife have talked about doing 6 to 12 months down in the States as well. Arizona seems to be the leading location right now. She loves the kind of Phoenix Scottsdale region for a bunch of reasons. And, I do too. So maybe could see that happen in the near future. How to bring a rifle and meat trophies across the border? Well, I already talked about the meat and the trophies. For a rifle, if you're a Canadian, you need a 6NIA, which is a permit for a non-resident alien to bring a rifle into the United States. As a Canadian citizen, we're pretty lucky. It used to be that you had to have a tag or you had to have a competition. You had to have a reason, and then the permit would be tied to that reason, and you'd only be allowed to take it down there for that specific thing that would be on your permit. That's not the case anymore. As a Canadian resident, if you fill out one of these 6NIAs and you email it into the ATF, they will get back to you usually 2 to 3 weeks, and they give you a permit for a year. And as long as it's that firearm with that ammunition, you can go back and forth with that rifle as often as you want for a year. So super easy. Curious on the traveling and applying for US-based hunts. So I'm going to go over this real lightly, and maybe I'll do a deeper podcast on it in the future. Most Western states, most all states, have resident and non-resident tags. If you're applying for the non-resident tag, they don't care where you live. You could live in California. You could live in Canada. You could live in Syria. You could live in Australia. Does not matter. You are applying for the tags that are in the non-resident pool. So you literally, just this morning, I applied for tags in Wyoming, Arizona, and New Mexico. You literally, for next year, obviously, you literally go onto the Game and Fish website, you create a sportsman's ID, and you just apply for the tags. It takes 5 minutes. If anybody is interested in doing this, I strongly recommend signing up for Go Hunt. Only because, you know, wading through the different seasons and regulations and like actually applying for the tag is easy. Deciding what tag to apply for is mind-numbingly difficult. It's way different than it is in Canada. Like, a lot of these, you know, if you look at mule deer in New Mexico, there can be up to 9 different seasons between early archery, early rifles, late rifles, muzzle loaders, late archery. And they could all be anywhere from 5 to 15 days long. And they could be in, and then they have all of these in like 40 different units. So there's literally like hundreds of choices. So, and they all have different draw odds and different trophy potential. And so trying to figure out where to apply is far more challenging than the actual application process. Applying is easy. And so in my experience, Go Hunt has done the best job of bringing all that information under one roof. And You can look up draw odds. They'll keep track of your points. Like, they come out with strategy articles every year. You got to take all of it with a grain of salt because everybody's looking at the same information. But as a general starting point for some like generic statewide information about where the trophy units are and that kind of stuff, like it is the best resource I've found on the internet. But it's not that hard. It just takes a little bit of work. I would love to hear your experience traveling with gear. I will assume that he means hunting gear. And as I mentioned in the kind of gear portion, I'm working on a better system for that. Best way to support the channel, go join Mindful Reviews. It can cost as little as $5 a month. It is the best way to support what I do. So if you want to see more hunt films, you want to see more gear reviews, you want to see more non-sponsored, unbiased content, go join Mindful Reviews. I'm launching another company on February 12th called Forged in the Backcountry. And I will talk more about that on the 12th of February. Let's talk Revic binos. Good, bad, ugly. Don't be a pussy. Hold no punches. Yeah, not impressed. Would not buy them currently. So more to come on that. Sneak Tech. Quietest stalking overshoe. Yes, I don't have a ton of opinion with or a ton of experience with other options. The Sneak Tech is basically this Berber fleece slipper that has like elastic bands on it, like webbing, that goes over your boot so that when you're stalking, you can put this thing on and it really muffles. Stalking in the desert is challenging because there's this like broken lava rock everywhere and other, everything is crunchy and crinkly and dry. And so when you put these Berber fleece overshoes on, it kind of muffles the sound of you walking. And in my opinion, it's better than socks. Socks can be challenging in the desert. Like I challenge you to take your boots off and walk for 100 yards in Arizona or New Mexico or West Texas. Like you're going to get the shit kicked out of you. And these overshoe stocking slippers are really good. When is the video coming out? So I got home and my laptop was dead. I think on the flight home, it got some liquid in it and it has half the footage from the hunt on the laptop because all my cards were full halfway through, dumped them onto the laptop, re-recorded on new cards. I think this was a takeaway for me. I'm going to invest in a double set of cards. Now, 99% chance that data is fine. The laptop might be toast. I was a PC tech for years. What it would take to fry a hard drive so that you can't get information off of it is pretty severe. And so even if the laptop is toast, I think I have a very reasonable expectation of being able to get the data off the hard drive. So I think the video will be fine. I'm not freaking out about it yet, but it's going to delay it. So hopefully I'll have the laptop back by Monday. Give me a week to pump out the film. You know, we're probably looking at the 29th or 30th to release. Was this an archery hunt? If not, do you think it's conducive to archery? It was an archery hunt. I think it's a doable archery hunt. I think it's very, very challenging. And the reward is not so great. Like you're going to bust your ass to take home a 140 type deer. Do electrolyte pills work the same as the powder pockets? Yes, they do, 100%. In fact, I highly recommend them almost over the electrolyte packets because I will get to that point on a hunt where I start cramping up all over the place and I've had nosebleeds and other things from dehydration, and having some salt pills or electrolyte pills in your possibles pouch so you can just smash a couple of them and get that hyper concentrated dose, I think is a great tool to have in your toolkit. The thing that I will note is that you want them to have an appropriate ratio of sodium, potassium, and magnesium, because you can find some that only have sodium or only have sodium and magnesium, but you want all three of those in the right ratio. There's some great options on Amazon. I think there's a brand just called like Salt Pills or something, but they have two versions with and without the magnesium and the potassium. So get the version with. All right, folks, there we go. New Mexico archery mule deer. All kinds of stuff coming up on the horizon, from hunts to content to other shit. So, you know, stay in touch, keep listening, you know, get excited. 2024 is going to be an absolute monster of a year. Lots of great podcast lines up with, you know, crazy good guests. So, as always, I truly appreciate the support. If you want to go join Mindful Reviews, mindful-reviews.com. You want to support any of the other projects, I greatly appreciate it. If you could, you know, share, comment, like, subscribe on this particular piece of content, that would really help me getting it out to more people. And other than that, I hope you're all having a good year so far and kicking some ass. So thank you, as always, for tuning in.